compound. But Marines must be in trouble. They'd go.
Someone in the shit, Sergeant Cassidy?
Someone asked.
Yes,
he replied grimly.
Bravo Company.
Kids shivered in the drizzle. Some pulled on flak jackets for warmth.
I want to see all the acting platoon commanders,
Cassidy said. Three former squad leaders walked up to him. China, for 2nd Platoon, Connolly, 1st, and Campion, 3rd. Three concerned faces looked at Cassidy.
Someone beat the colonel's guard tonight. Almost killed him.
He looked straight at China as he talked.
A good fucking Marine. 3 more days until he would have rotated out of this fucking place. And some assholes beat the shit out of him because he drew guard duty. Some real proud dudes.
China stayed cool. Connolly and Campion exchanged glances.
A dummy grenade was tossed into the colonel's quarters. It had the Bravo Company roster on it.
He paused.
With some modifications.
Like what, Gunny?
Connolly asked. Cassidy was still looking at China.
But the ones who died for their country had their names crossed out and the word murdered was typed in.
You think someone from Bravo Company did it, Gunny?
China asked, wide-eyed. Cassidy hated China, but at the same time admired his cool.
I don't think anything, he said. I've got orders to collect all grenades, weapons, claymores, everything. I want them stacked up in piles right here by platoon.
What kind of shit is this, Gunny?
Connolly said. Others had gathered around the group of four and echoed his protest.
Just do what you're told, con man.
I earned that fucking rifle.
Yes, you did. You all did.
Cassidy clenched his teeth. He looked at their drawn, haggard faces, their dead eyes. He looked around him at the squalor, saw the kids he'd humped with through the heat and cold, now shivering in the darkness, puzzled, angry. He wanted to cry out to them to make this easier on him. But no one moved.
Am I going to have to take them away from you?
Cassidy asked.
You ain't wrong, Gunny,
Connolly said. He walked over to his hooch, pulled out his rifle, and threw it in the mud. He then sat down and stared at it.
Pick it up, con man.
Fuck you, Cassidy.
Cassidy strode over, towering above Connolly, who continued to stare at the muddy rifle. Then Connolly wrenched around, reached into the sagging hooch, and pulled out Vancouver's modified machine gun. He threw it into the mud.
There. The fucking asshole can have that too.
Tears welled up in his eyes, and he tried, unsuccessfully, to blink them away. Cassidy stared at the gun lying in the mud.
I want all the grenades too, con man,
Cassidy finally said.
That's right. You fucking bastards want everything, don't you?
Where's your fucking pride, con man?
Cassidy said softly.
I left it on that fucking hill we just abandoned.
Cassidy wheeled away. His parade ground voice came back.
God damn it now, I want all ammunition and grenades piled neatly. I want the rifles stacked in an orderly manner. I want the stacks right here.
Some kids began to move for their weapons. Then China said,
uh-uh.
Everyone stopped. China reached for his machine gun and threw it into the mud in front of him. He stood erect above it. Others did the same. Soon the area was littered with grenades, rifles, ammunition belts, bandoliers, claymores, and captured weapons.
How about our fucking can openers, Gunny? That little chicken shit fuck one of John Wayne's? I got a needle in my sewing kit. You want that?
Cassidy stood alone, saying nothing. Eventually he motioned to his team from H&S to collect the weapons. The Marines from Bravo Company, disgusted, started crawling back into their hooches or rolling up in wet ponchos on the ground. China continued to stand over his machine gun, waiting. When one of the H&S Marines approached it, China kicked it away. The kid stood up.
Look, man, this ain't my idea.
He bent over for the gun again. Again, China kicked it aside. The kid turned to look at Cassidy, who hadn't noticed the exchange, then turned back to China.
Hey, come on, just let me get this shit over with. I ain't got nothing against you.
You touch that gun, and I'll kill you.
Christ, don't get personal about it.
China leaned over.
Ain't nobody getting my machine gun but Cassidy. You pick it up, and you're gonna get fucked with real bad, whether I be here or not.
All right, all right.
The kid moved on. Cassidy had noticed. He walked up to China.
How come Shaffron didn't pick up your gun?
He didn't want to.
Did you threaten him, you fucking puke?
How can I threaten somebody? I ain't got no weapons.
Somebody snickered. Cassidy was aware now that everyone remaining was watching him to see what he would do. He and China stood there, eyes locked.
You gonna do your duty, Cassidy, and pick up my gun? China asked softly.
Cassidy looked directly into China's eyes. His hands began to tremble. Then he bent over to get the machine gun. China kicked it away.
Parker,
he said. Cassidy stood up. His voice quivered with anger.
If you think I'm going to order you to do something so you can refuse it, become a fucking martyr, and hang around in the rear waiting for trial with the rest of the vomits you call your friends, then you got another think coming.
He reached again for the gun. Again, China towed it aside.
Broya, he said.
Cassidy stood.
I lost friends too, China.
How a fucking cog have a friend? How a fucking cog ever be a man?
Cassidy clenched his fists and saw China steel himself for the blow. Cassidy hesitated, struggling to restrain his anger.
Manhood's something you'll never understand, he said.
He stooped down and picked up China's machine gun.
You make me sick, cog.
China walked away toward his hooch, leaving Cassidy with the muddy weapon. The rest of Bravo Company turned their backs on him. Some, however, did not forget him.
It's time to off the motherfucker, Henry said. Now!
We've seen enough killing,
China said quietly. Henry stood up and whirled around.
Man, do I have to listen to you? We seen enough killing shit. Like I'm some kind of small boy look wonder eyes at Big Daddy home from the wars. You know who you've been killing out there, don't you? Your own brothers. Yeah, your own brothers. That's who you've been getting you enough killing with. Well, I say we finish with that shit. We're gonna do some killing our own. And for our own.
China could see that Henry had most of the brothers with him. Still, some of them, like Mole, looked to China to say something. China's rhetoric failed him.
You're gonna just sit on your ass while that racist cracker throw our brother Mallory in a fucking Connex box like some kind of animal?
Henry asked.
And then you run your ass up that fucking hill like you some kind of nigger Audie Murphy and half your fucking company get killed for nothing, and he send you fucking Coca-Colas like you on some sort of football team? Hey, man, and then cut your balls off by taking your rifles? You don't think maybe that fucking lifer hasn't been practicing violence on you? Or you just turning white in more ways than one? Maybe you dare to be a white motherfucker and leave you all them white spots.
The familiar taunt made China clamp down his teeth so hard that he was afraid he'd break a molar. He knew what Henry was doing, and he knew that too much was at stake to give in to his rage. Henry strutted over to the Macassar ebony trunk and opened the heavy lid.
You think about it, brother, while I fix us up some good Brother Rugi and try and understand why you so fucked up.
He carefully removed the clothing and other items in the trunk to reveal a beautifully crafted box with a sliding drawer. He opened the drawer and took out a silver bong with a crystal water bowl and an ornate cigarette roller and some paper. China took the plunge.
You're the one that's fucked up. But you think you're gonna accomplish killing one more fucked up garden country pork chop? He's just a fucking cog in the machinery. He crawled in front of me, man.
Leaving the lid to the trunk open, Henry simply smiled at China. He coolly walked over to the matching dresser, removed the false bottom in the drawer, and pulled out a small plastic bag of marijuana. Then he took a diamond-inlaid silver cigarette lighter from the top drawer. Still smiling, he turned to face China.
You the one give him your gun.
He cut off your fucking balls, the way I see it.
China rose to the bait, but not in the way Henry wanted.
You think I'm not ready to roll on them suckers? You think I don't see they're a bunch of sick motherfuckers?
China turned to the other brothers, not even addressing Henry.
What you people think this is, some sort of gang bullshit? We're not about just going out and doing violence to cut up some people for the hell of it. We're about stopping things at the source of the evil. The source. We gotta overturn a racist society. If it come to a fight, it's gonna be a real motherfucker. We can't let them get us one at a time.
He turned to Henry, who had sat on his cot and was carefully building a joint with the ornate roller.
You think I'm not souped up for a motherfucker over this? You think that I don't know Payback gonna be a motherfucker for that racist cracker? But Payback gotta come right. All that happened with you is they throw you black ass in another Connex box just like Mallory. They do worse for you. They throw you upside down in one of those fucking punishment holes like they do to the gooks. And you being so deep they have to pump sunshine to you all the way from Texas.
That got a laugh from the other brothers, and China started to feel better.
They send you so far out in the bush they're gonna use rock apes to carry you mail.
Then China pounded his fist on his palm.
We got to get power! One dead Georgia cracker I dropped in a bucket over here. I left dead Georgia crackers all over that fucking hill. And dead brothers, too. Dead people ain't worth shit. They're just big nothings.
Power,
Henry sneered.
Shit.
He licked the glue on the joint and smoothed the paper into place.
You and your jive fucking talk, China. Mao say power come from the barrel of a gun. That dude know where it's at. What you gonna do? Go back to the world and sing, We Shall Overcome?
Now Henry got the laughter.
Spammy,
China said.
Well, what you gonna do?
Henry coolly licked the cigarette paper along the seam, sealing it shut, watching China through narrowed eyes.
I can just see China singing, We Shall Overcome, as he walks in for his cyanide shower.
Henry's friends now chimed in.
Hey, Henry, you tell him. Yeah, China, how come you not running with us no more? Hey, come on, brother. What's into you, huh, man? Nothing into me.
China fired back at them.
I've been out in the fucking bush trying to straighten shit out while you jive-ass mothers in here talking about revolution. I work in revolution. You spare me, brother,
Henry said. Just 'cause you ain't figured a way to get your ass out of the jungle. He laughed. If you really work in revolution, then you better start right here. You frag the motherfucker. That way we teach those fucking bigots that Payback start right away.
They're gonna fuck with us, we're gonna fuck with them worse.
He put the joint in his mouth and started striking at the flint of the lighter. China, his senses heightened from months in the bush, smelled the lighter fluid. It annoyed and slightly nauseated him.
I told you there's no point. He's just a little cog in the works. Besides, we get our own point across without killing. We need to arm the black man for defense. We ain't about murdering people. We maybe pop a smoke under his ass some night or maybe put a note on it like we did for the colonel. You gonna write another note?
Henry asked. He blew out a long exhalation of smoke. The others laughed.
Later for that, huh? Way later.
He handed off the joint and then turned his back on China and reached under his cot. He pulled out a fragmentation grenade.
This ain't no smoke,
he said, tossing it lightly up and down in his palm. He tossed it over to China.
I think you chicken shit to use it.
Nobody laughed. China knew in a flash of insight that once again Henry had him coming or going. If he did what Henry wanted, Henry was the leader. If he didn't do it, he was disgraced, and Henry was still the leader.
We see who's chicken shit, China said.
He pulled the pin of the grenade and everything seemed to go in slow motion for him. He was so weary of slaughter that his own didn't matter anymore. It was the same tired, suicidal feeling he had walking off the hill in the mortar fire. He was only dimly aware of people shouting, running, scrambling for the door of the tent.
"He's fucking crazy, man! A fucking frag going off! Jesus Christ!"
China, his tongue on his lips, concentrating on the count, tossed the grenade back to Henry and watched the spoon fly off toward the side of the tent. Henry, his eyes wide, tossed the grenade back to China and dived out of the door for the wet ground. China threw the grenade into Henry's open trunk, slammed down the heavy lid, and threw a flak jacket on top of it. He dived for the far side of the tent behind a pile of sea bags, flinging himself down, rolling off the runway matting of the floor, face down onto the dirt just beneath it at the edge of the tent, covering his head with his hands and arms. The explosion pounded his ears and body. He lay on the damp dirt. The silence and darkness were gradually filled by painful ringing in his ears, then by the smell of TNT. His head ached. But he was unharmed. He heard the excited babble of voices outside the tent. He stood up. Someone opened the now ragged flap of the ruined tent. Henry walked in. He struck the lighter and coolly looked at the splinters of his once solid ebony trunk, at his shrapnel-pitted dresser, the ripped sea bags.
"You gonna pay for this, China?"
China knew Henry wasn't talking about the furniture. He also knew that although Henry's image had taken a hit, power always trumped image, and he was beginning to learn ideology. Power was the ability to reward and punish. Henry could reward with money and drugs. He could punish by withholding money and drugs. A nice combination. Ultimately, however, Henry wielded the power of punishment, held only by a self-selected few. He was willing to murder. China knew that if a man could kill someone, everyone knew that he could kill anyone. The only way to stand up to that kind of power was to be willing to die. China walked back to the company area, uneasy and apprehensive.
Chapter 22. A helicopter carried Mellis the 30 miles from the hospital ship back to reality, dropping him to the ground at the Dong Ha airfield. From there, he hitched a ride on an army truck 13 kilometers south, across a dreary wasteland of abandoned rice farms to Quang Tri, the location of the division's administrative rear. Mellis could tell that the army driver was curious about him. After all, Mellis had a patch over one eye, several boxes of cigars under his arm, and a sword hanging from a complicated strap over his shoulder. Finally, the driver could contain himself no longer.
"Where'd you get the sword?"
he asked. Mellis was amused. "Out in the bush," he said.
"Ah."
There were some things he couldn't tell the uninitiated. For them, the bush should, and would, remain a mystery. In Bravo Company's unpainted plywood office, a clerk was pecking at a typewriter. He had his shirt off and sweat glistened on his broad back, which also bore the scar of a bullet exit wound. Cigarette smoke curled limply upward in the humid coastal air. Above the clerk, covering the entire back wall, was a blown-up picture of a beautiful model in a girdle and brassiere advertisement. A note had been handwritten by the model on the large poster in neat round script. "To the men of Bravo Company, 1st Battalion, 24th Marines, you're doing a great job. Love, Cindy." It was dated February 1967, just 2 years earlier, but in some ways a bygone era. The clerk told Mellis that Fitch was leaving for Okinawa in the afternoon and filled him in on the staged fragging, the note wrapped around the grenade, and Simpson's disarming the company. He also said that Cassidy had come to the rear, ostensibly to say goodbye to Fitch, but more to drink himself into oblivion after having to be the one who actually took the weapons. Then the clerk said that the company would be skying out tomorrow for Iger, and that Hawk had been given command.
According to Scuttlebutt, Mulvaney himself had given Hawk the job. Malice said he was glad. Then he walked over to Supply to get new gear for the bush. There he was told he'd have to sign for a deduction from his paycheck in order to pay for his old rifle before they would issue him a new one. The fucking Navy is a goddamn thing. I'm sorry, Lieutenant, but I'm not paying for the fucking thing. If you ever want to go home, you better have all your fucking bills paid. They ain't paid, we don't endorse your orders. I don't care if you stay here the rest of your life. Mellis paid $127. He left with his new rifle and trudged over to another supply tent to rummage around for his sea bag. When he found it, he went through the contents looking for items he'd want to take to the bush. He smiled as he held up several of the green T-shirts and boxer shorts his mother had dyed, remembering how he had asked Goodwin about whether or not to wear underwear in the bush. He threw the underwear into a trash can and headed for the staff club to forget where he would be in 24 hours. The staff club had improved since he and Goodwin had last been there, drowning their fears. A fancy Akai tape deck was now sitting on the bar. The bar itself had some nice new inlay work, and several new beer signs rolled, sparkled, and advertised sky-blue waters from out of the gloom. Newly installed, high on the wall behind the bar, was Vancouver's sawed-off machine gun. It was flanked by two captured Russian machine guns. Staff Sergeant Cassidy sat alone at a table, a bottle of Jack Daniel's Black Label in front of him. No one else was in the club. Gunny Klump, the manager, had gone out to do errands, leaving Cassidy to mind the store. Mellis said he could use a beer, and Cassidy disappeared behind the bar. He emerged with an armload of cold, wet cans, which he set ceremoniously on the table in front of Mellis.
"No sense in getting up and down except to piss," he said.
He was already well along on his own mystery tour. Mellis reached for one of the cans, punched two holes in it, and chugged the beer down. Then he opened another can and leaned back in the chair. He noticed an air conditioner half installed in the plywood wall.
"Air conditioning," he mused. "Not bad."
"Yeah," Cassidy muttered. "Klump figured he'll get people in from the other battalions once the spring heat hits. It'll help the profits."
"Here's to fucking profits," Mellis said, lifting his can. He chugged it, thinking of both Hamilton and the $127.
"I guess you heard about the skipper," Cassidy said. "I'm sure it all looked nice and voluntary."
"You can't fool the fucking troops," Cassidy muttered.
He took another drink of whiskey, and his grip tightened on his shot glass until his knuckles showed white through his jungle rot scars.
"I should have been up there with you. It was when you needed me worst."
Mellis was tempted to tell Cassidy who had gotten him transferred so that he wouldn't feel so bad. He saw that Cassidy was looking up at Vancouver's machine gun, polished and oily. Displayed beneath a large fleur-de-lis imposed on crossed rifles, the emblem of the 24th Marines, Les Braves des Bois Bello.
"I've had to do a lot of shitty jobs since I've been in the Corps, sir," Cassidy said.
He brought his gaze back to Mellis.
"But the worst thing I ever had to do was go from man to man and collect their rifles. 20 years ago, anybody try and take a Marine's rifle, he'd be fucking plugged. Shit, 5 years ago."
"Times change," Mellis muttered. He thought about the girl in the girdle and brassiere advertisement.
"I had to go from man to man. Some of them I'd been with on Wind River and Korak and the DMZ op. And I had to search them like fucking prisoners."
Cassidy turned his watery blue eyes on Mellis.
"Well, I did it because it was my job, but I didn't like it, Lieutenant. I could feel them hating me."
He stopped, noticed that he was clenching his fists, and slowly straightened his fingers.
"I guess that's why I had to get the fuck away from there."
Mellis and Cassidy got drunk. It was just after noon when Mellis left Cassidy passed out at the table and dragged himself back to the company office. He pulled himself wearily up the back stairs to where two cots were separated from the rest of the office by a hanging wool blanket. He knew he would have a pounding headache as the day wore on, unless he could keep drinking. Could he keep drinking forever? He threw himself onto a cot.
The wool blanket felt hot and scratchy beneath his sweaty cheek. His mind and the floor beneath him whirled. He again felt as if he were on a conveyor belt heading for a cliff. Every minute brought him 1 minute closer to tomorrow, and tomorrow he'd be back in the bush. His mind, unwilling to face the thought, closed down. At VCB, the newbie's tension about the coming operation was already palpable. The old hands, like China and Mole, talked quietly to each other or simply cleaned their rifles and machine guns over and over. They had learned how to keep disturbing feelings at bay. They ate. They drank beer. They elaborately concocted cups of coffee. They tried to get on KP duty. They smoked marijuana. They joked. They thought of girls back home. They masturbated. The new black kids were especially drawn to the two black machine gunners, taciturn gods of the bush who wore dark green hangman's nooses around their necks. China would hold court, engage them, talk a little politics, laugh off any fears they expressed. Mole spoke only to China and the other old hands. The items on his personal agenda did not include making new friends. China and Mole were cleaning their machine guns near the opening of a large 10-man tent with a packed mud floor, which they shared with 18 other black Marines. In the front of the tent, when the flaps were pulled back fully onto the roof, they could get enough light to see what they were doing and still be out of the rain. But the rain had become less constant. The Vietnamese spring was coming, and it would be followed by the relentless dry season. They had their guns completely broken down and were meticulously cleaning each component. The air smelled of Hops No. 9 powder solvent, sent from home in response to many anxious requests, the combination of burning diesel fuel and shit from the latrines and mothballs from the tent canvas. Mole looked up from his gun and chuckled softly.
"I'll be goddamn, China. Looky what we got coming up the road."
China looked and smiled, seeing Aaron and Pat. Pat was at a loose heel, padding along silently, as always, tongue out just slightly, looking as if he were on a Sunday stroll. His red ears flicked forward when he heard Mole's voice. Aaron, noticing the ear flick but unable to hear anything, followed the direction of the ears. He saw Mole and China and raised his shotgun high in the air with one hand, grinning. Aaron touched fists with China and Mole. Pat sat down, still in heel position.
"I thought she was out in the fucking off shower or some badass place like that," China said.
Aaron grinned.
"All over. Coming back to you guys. I hear we're skying out tomorrow."
The two gunners nodded but said nothing. Pat started whining, wanting to break heel. He had tuned in on a figure coming up the road. It was Hawk. Pat whined again. Aaron laughed and released him. Pat bounded down the road to greet Hawk. Soon the two of them were roughhousing together, Hawk hugging the dog's strong neck, cradling it in his arms and moving Pat's head back and forth, while Pat kept trying to nuzzle into Hawk's crotch and at the same time rub his own sides, cat-like, against Hawk's thighs. Hawk, still laughing at Pat's antics, reached the three Marines. He motioned for China and Mole to remain seated.
"Enough, okay," Aaron said to the dog. "Show the skipper some respect."
His tone then altered just slightly. "Sit." Pat immediately was on his haunches, panting happily.
"He sure as hell likes you, Skipper," Aaron said. "Not everyone gets a greeting like that."
Hawk was rubbing Pat's head and ears. He looked up at the three Marines.
"Yeah, I'm real glad to see you two back," Hawk said. "Feel blind out there without you."
Then he put a hand on Mole's shoulder and sidled between Mole and China, poking his head into the interior of the tent without saying anything to them. He pulled his head back and turned to the two gunners.
"I got word you chased some chucks out of the tent."
"I'm out of here," Aaron said, grinning. He snapped his fingers softly and Pat stood.
0430 in the supply tent," Hawk said.
"Aye, sir. Nice to be back."
Aaron left, Pat padding along at his left side as usual. The three watched for a moment as the dog and handler walked away.
"Well?"
Hawk asked.
"Nobody chased no one, Skipper,"
China said. Hawk looked at him for a while.
"Uh-huh. No, honest injuns, sir. They just left on their own."
Hawk thought about it for a while.
You know, China, I don't give a fuck about congregating. Never did. Everyone's going to turn green when we board those choppers tomorrow.
He unconsciously looked skyward.
You guys ready?
They both cocked their heads to the side, and Mole shrugged his shoulders.
I need you to keep the newbies steady, okay?
We can do that, sir, China said. Hawk looked at them, nodding almost imperceptibly.
Good. Thanks.
The two gunners watched him walk away down the road.
He's decent, Mole said.
Yeah, said China. He is. We got lucky for once.
China? You think we should tell him?
Mole said in a low murmur.
China shone the beam of his smile on his friend.
Say what? Tell him what?
Get real, China. About Henry Off and Cassidy.
That be old shit. They ain't doing nothing.
I don't know,
said Mole.
Hey, man. No way, brother. I've been talking to those guys, and they see what I mean about the Panther Brotherhood. We starting here in the Nam, and we're bringing the true grit back home. We'd be tested in the fire and tested under fire.
Mole cut him short.
Just you stop, China. Just for once dispense with the revolutionary country preacher bullshit. Henry don't give a shit about you, Black Panther mumbo-jumbo. He just need the brothers to be retailing while he wholesaling. If he have to kill Cassidy to stay in charge, he gonna do it.
China looked down on the parts spread out on Mole's poncho.
He just don't get it, he said softly.
You just don't get it.
Mellis was awakened by the slight scraping of a boot on the plywood floor. His heart started pounding. He was covered in sweat and his head ached. Fitch, who was looking down at Mellis, sadness on his face, had deliberately scraped the boot so he wouldn't put Mellis into combat overdrive by waking him too abruptly.
Hi, Jim, Mellis said.
Fitch sat down on the opposite cot.
You fucked up, Mellis?
Just had a few beers with Cassidy is all. What time is it?
Fitch looked at his watch. 1 o'clock.
You're already on civilian time.
Never left it, Fitch said.
Mellis swung his feet to the floor. His head was hot and pounding. He ran his hands through his hair, feeling sweat in it. He wiped them on his new stiff trousers.
I did manage to save my fucking boots, he said, looking at their familiar whiteness.
There was an awkward silence.
I guess then you heard I was leaving,
Fitch finally said.
Yeah.
Alice didn't know how to go on talking about it. He saw Fitch flush slightly, probably taking the silence as condemnation, so he said,
I'm real glad you're getting out.
Me too.
Fitch forced a half-smile, and there was another awkward silence.
When you leaving?
Mellis asked. 6 o'clock. Getting the big bird out of Dong Ha. I ought to be in Oki by day after tomorrow.
Laundry officer, huh?
Mellis smiled. Socks and T-shirts division.
You could have gone to Mulvaney about this. It's a bum deal.
I'd have to go through Simpson.
Shit, Skipper, back channel. You must know that's how it works.
Fitch looked away toward the plywood wall, assuming the familiar thousand-yard stare. Mellis supposed that an entire movie was unreeling inside Fitch's mind. Fitch finally turned and looked into Mellis's good eye.
I don't want to go back to the bush. I'd do anything to stay alive.
He started stuffing gear into an already bulging sea bag. He combed his hair, bending slightly to look into a steel mirror nailed to a 2x4. Then he carefully put on a neatly starched stateside utility cover. His single silver lieutenant's bar gleamed, newly polished.
Still Dapper Dan, Mellis said.
There's a place in Da Nang called the White Elephant, Fitch said, taking the cover off and smoothing his dark hair, and it's got round-eyed pussy in it. Red Cross girls, stewardesses, air-conditioned. There's even a goddamn German girl who sells Mercedes to AID fat cats.
and in about 3 hours I'm going to be there getting fucked up and I'm going to forget I ever saw this place. He hoisted the sea bag onto his shoulder. Mella stood up, shakily. There was a sudden clutch in his throat. He could see Fitch's lips quiver, then go into the tight, pursed expression that Fitch used to hide his feelings from the rest of the company.
"You take care of yourself, Mellis," Fitch said. "I'll write and let you guys know what happened to me."
"We'd like that."
"You tell everyone to look me up when they get back to the world. You know it doesn't matter if they're snuffs."
"They know it." They stood there looking at each other. Mellis was incredibly happy that Fitch had made it out alive. Just before dark, Mellis bought a bottle of Jack Daniels from Gunnery Sergeant Klump and hitched a ride over to Mag 39, where he caught one of the last birds heading out to VCB. The empty, darkening land rolled beneath him. He thought of Cassidy, scared, getting drunk in the dim staff club. If it had gotten that bad, he'd better talk with the Jayhawk about it. Then he thought of Fitch in the brightly lit nightclub called the White Elephant, where American girls carried on with overweight AID and cords personnel. Then he thought of himself, heading for the dark, jungle-covered mountains. 10 more months to go, he mused. 5 more Trail of Tears ops. 5 more Matterhorns. Mellis now knew that there was nothing special about Matterhorn and the Trail of Tears op. Both were just ordinary war. 10 minutes later, the chopper had reached the mountains, and the jungle sea rolled in ever larger swells over the first of the foothills. Mellis pulled out his map, this was now a compulsive habit, and got his bearings as a prominent peak flashed beneath him, a river winding in a tight S-curve around it. Then they were over the next upthrust of hills, now higher and more rugged. Mellis untied Vancouver's sword from the side of his pack and crawled over to an open porthole, squeezing past the door gunner, who was watching him while at the same time idly moving his eyes back and forth across the ground below. When Mellis reached the porthole, the blast of the air threatened to pull the patch off his eye. He tugged it back into place and then knelt, leaning into the rushing air, holding the sword out in front of him. Mellis looked at it for about half a minute, remembering. Then he threw the sword into the twilight. He watched it falling behind them, twisting, catching a glint of the dying light before it merged into the vast, unbroken gray-green below. Mellis then unfolded his map and carefully marked the spot where it had fallen with a cross, printing V.S., Vancouver sword, next to it. The door gunner shook his head.
"You fucking grunts, man!" he shouted at him. "Crazy motherfuckers!"
Coming up on VCB in the early evening, Mellis felt the nostalgia that many people feel on coming home, no matter how squalid the setting. Below him, a few lights, careless of NVA rockets, blinked out from behind the blackout curtains. When he got out of the chopper, a small group of field-grade officers from division staff were there, waiting to be picked up, with briefcases in hand and 45s in shiny black holsters. Mellis walked silently on the dark road toward the battalion area, passing the tents where he'd awaited the launching of the Bald Eagle. A company from 19th Marines was there. The Marines were whittling, writing letters, cleaning rifles, and playing cards to counteract boredom and fear. The air was noticeably warmer than it had been the last time he'd been at VCB. He reached Bravo Company's supply tent. Someone had made an attempt to straighten its sagging exterior. The interior was in good order, with sea bags stacked neatly in the back on wooden pallets to keep them off the mud. The old writing table was there, with 2 candles burning on it. 3 strangers sat inside.
"Can we help you, Marine?"
one of them asked sharply. He was beefed up and obviously had just arrived from the world. He had a knife stuck in his boot. Mellis wanted to groan.
"Fuck," Mellis said. "Is this Bravo Company or what? I'm Lieutenant Mellis. Where's Hawk and Scar?"
The 3 strangers stood up. Mellis sloughed off his pack, undid his belt suspenders, and let everything fall with a thud to the metal runway matting beneath his feet.
"Welcome back, sir," the man said. "We've heard a lot about you.
I'm Staff Sergeant Irvine, and this is Staff Sergeant Bentham, and this is Lieutenant LaValle, sir.
He hesitated a moment.
We heard that you lost the eye.
So did everyone else, Mellis said. Mellis shook hands with each of them, playing the role of silent, wounded hero. He could see that the new lieutenant was in awe of him, just as he himself would have been in awe of a veteran a couple of months ago. Their reaction meant nothing to him now, other than informing him that tales of Matterhorn had probably been exaggerated far beyond anything he could have concocted, and that the new kids would be jittery as hell. Mellis dug into his pack and pulled out the bottle of Jack Daniels.
Any word on what's happening?
The new lieutenant told him that they were going to Eiger and would spend about a week there guarding the artillery battery. Charlie Company would be dropped into the river valley north of Eiger at the same time and would move north. After a week, the two companies would flip-flop. Alpha was already on Skycap, with Delta Company sweeping the Sui Tien Han River Valley just to its immediate east.
When we leaving? Mellis asked. 0600 tomorrow?
Mellis grunted.
Then I guess they got time tonight to get fucked up.
He held the bottle up to the new lieutenant and the two new staff sergeants.
Anybody want some?
It's your last chance.
They each took a small shot in a coffee mug or canteen cup to show Mellis that they were friendly.
You think the zone will be hot when Charlie hits it?
The lieutenant asked, holding his mug between his knees and leaning forward.
Do I look like a fucking gypsy?
Mellis wisecracked.
Nah, I don't think so.
He looked at the amber liquid reflecting the candlelight.
How are the troops?
We've got a lot of boots, Lieutenant.
It was the other staff sergeant, Bentham, who'd spoken up. Mellis looked at him, surprised. He talked as if he'd been in combat before. Mellis was thankful for that. He'd probably made sergeant on his last tour, then had gotten promoted to staff back in the world, and had been shipped out here as soon as his 2 years of grace were over.
Which platoon you got?
I got 3rd platoon. I have that until we get one more lieutenant.
And you two?
Mellis asked the others.
I'll be honchoing 2nd platoon with Lieutenant Goodwin,
the staff sergeant with the knife in his boot answered.
And I've got your old platoon, LaValle said, smiling.
They ain't mine, Mellis said, laughing.
You can blame all your troubles on a guy named Fracasso. Of course I'll take credit for anything they do that's good.
From what I hear, they never really had much time to feel like they were Lieutenant Fracasso's bunch,
LaValle said. Mellis swirled the whiskey.
Nah. He was one hell of a good guy. They were his platoon, all right.
He looked at LaValle, feeling a wave of sadness. Then he tossed down his whiskey and grinned, despite the empty hole in him that the whiskey couldn't fill.
Don't you worry about it. They'll be yours in no time. After you've been here a while, you can tell a winner from a loser in 1 second flat. You don't have anything to worry about.
Mellis tried to include everyone as he spoke, and he was sure everyone felt included. But he knew that the Jayhawk could also tell a winner from a loser. The guy with the fucking knife in his boot was going with Scar so that Scar could keep him from doing too much damage.
As for me, Mellis added, I'm going to go find a couple friends of mine and get knee-walking, commode-hugging drunk, and if I'm at all successful, you might just have to take the company tomorrow while the skipper and executive officer try to regain consciousness.
He left them laughing and walked outside to look for Hawk and Goodwin. He saw a lone Marine walking up the road with a towel around his neck and a soap container in one hand, probably on his way to a final shower before the op.
Lieutenant Mellis, the kid shouted. We heard you was back.
It was Fisher.
Jesus Christ, Fisher! I thought you were back in the world. What do we have to do to get out of this fucking place?
Beats me, sir. I think we have to get killed.
They both stopped short at the words.
Then they both laughed.
They shook hands, grinning hugely.
You okay? I mean, down there?
Mellis nodded toward Fisher's crotch. Fisher brought him up to speed on his operation and recovery from the leech.
You mean everything works?
Mellis asked.
I ain't shitting you, Lieutenant, said Fisher. At least everything works in Japan. God damn, but I'm in love with Japanese women. They treat you real decent, sir.
So I've heard. Mellis replied.
I'm glad you're okay. I mean it, Fisher. I'm really glad.
Yeah, thanks, sir,
Fisher said.
Then his expression changed.
I heard about you guys getting in the deep shit.
Mellis didn't want to talk about Matterhorn.
You got your old squad back?
He asked. Fisher understood.
What's left of them?
He said.
It's still second squad, I guess.
He kicked at a mud clot.
Shit. 67 days to go. I'm a double-digit midget.
He grinned at Mellis.
I'm so short I can swing my legs sitting on my flak jacket. In fact, I'm so short, when I wear it, it drags on the ground. How many you got, Lieutenant?
303 and a wake-up. He pointed his finger at Fisher's face.
And don't give me any shit.
Shit, Lieutenant, you still ought to count in months. Mellis laughed, genuinely glad Fisher was getting short. He thrust the boxes of cigars at Fisher for him to hand out to the company and continued up the road. When he got to the BOQ tent, he found McCarthy, Murphy, Goodwin, and Hawk laughing around a footlocker with three bottles opened on it.
"Roll up for the Magical Mystery Tour," he sang. "I'm coming to take you away."
Two officers he didn't know groaned. One of them was trying to sleep.
"Holy Christ, another one."
"Hey!"
McCarthy shouted.
"It's Mellis! With a fucking patch!"
Murphy hugged Mellis and lifted him off the floor while Mellis held the bottle of whiskey above his head. Murphy sat Mellis down and McCarthy grabbed the bottle from him.
"Blessed be God forever,"
McCarthy said, holding it up to the light.
"For our good and the good of the Corps."
Mellis flipped him the bird.
"Scar and patch," Hawk said. "I don't have a company. I got a fucking animal act."
"Well, take your fucking act someplace else," the disgruntled would-be sleeper said. "I got a watch to stand in 3 hours."
"No fucking stamina,"
Hawk shot back. He stood and carefully put his stateside utility cover on his head, adjusting it in a steel mirror that hung on one of the tent poles.
"Come on,"
he said.
"Cassidy's in Quang Tri. Let's go over to his place and let these fine staff officers sleep."
Cassidy slept in a neat little room with its own exterior entry in the back of the S-4 tent. It was dark. Hawk eventually found a candle and lit it. He sat down on Cassidy's cot.
"By the way, Hawk," Mellis said, "congratulations on getting the company."
He held out his hand.
"It's number fucking one as far as I'm concerned."
"Thanks, Mel."
Hawk leaned back on the cot.
"It's funny, though. It's like a different company."
"I know what you mean."
McCarthy handed Mellis and Goodwin mugs filled with whiskey.
"Quit mourning over your fucking lost company," he said. "You're wasting my goddamn time."
"Then let's get this mystery tour on the road in my company jeep,"
Hawk said.
"Who's sober enough to drive to the Oak Club?"
Mellis looked around.
"I guess I'm about it," he said.
"Good,"
McCarthy said.
"You sit in the back and catch up with us. I'll fucking drive."
Soon all five of them were sitting around a table at the crude regimental Old Club, a hasty barricade against reality. A small generator hummed steadily, providing flickering light. The bare plywood walls still had the grade stamps showing. Exposed studs oozed pitch. A battered dartboard was nailed to one of the walls. They stuck candles directly onto the table by melting puddles of wax. Then they ordered 5 drinks apiece, the only way to avoid squabbling over who would get the honor of buying the last round. McCarthy and Murphy stood at the bar while the bartender measured out 25 shot glasses of whiskey and placed them on 2 large trays. Holding the trays out in front of them, McCarthy and Murphy made their way between tables. McCarthy had a package of Ritz crackers in his teeth. Hawk took the crackers and opened one end while the shot glasses were being placed on the table. McCarthy went back for 2 pitchers of water and 5 larger glasses that he set on the table in front of Hawk. Hawk had been counting the number of crackers in the package.
"Here," he said, 7 each, except I get 8 because I'm the company commander."
He passed the package over to Mellis, who took his 7 and passed it on to Goodwin. Hawk picked up a pitcher and started to silently question them in turn about their preferences for how much water they wanted in their whiskey, holding up 1, 2, or 3 fingers. When everyone had been served, he raised his glass and said,
Simplify, motherfuckers!
And threw down the first drink. Soon Mellis was deliciously high so that the bourbon tasted smooth and cool while simultaneously warming his belly. It was a magical contrast. He was well aware of the moment, in spite of the bourbon. He knew that the five of them had shared experiences no one else had shared or would share. He also knew it was unlikely that all of them would live to share such a moment again. Indeed, he could be the one missing. All the gaiety in the world, all the shouting, all the pain-numbing drunkenness would not conceal that lurking thought. But the lurking thought was what made him aware that this moment was precious.
"Hey, Mel," Hawk said. "When we get back to the world, we ought to go into business or something. Shit! All five of us! Wouldn't that be a gas?"
"With what we know, all we could do is compete with the mafia," Murphy said. "The only business you could ever run is a fucking bar," McCarthy said. "But I'd run one with you."
"I'll drink to that,"
Hawk said, lifting his glass.
"That's it. A fucking bar,"
he hiccuped.
"A special fucking bar,"
he giggled.
"We'll call it the bunker."
"Nah," Mellis said. "Not sophisticated enough. Call it Ellsworth."
"Fuck you and your sophistication, Jack,"
Goodwin said.
"We want a fucking bar, not some fairy discotheque."
"That's right,"
McCarthy said.
"And to get a drink there, you have to park your car 400 meters away and cut through solid bamboo and elephant grass with a machete to find it."
Mellis thought for a moment.
"Only you don't give the customers any fucking maps," he said.
"No maps."
He started to slap his palm on the table with each word.
"No fucking maps."
"But you could have one smoke grenade," Hawk said. "That way, if you give up, a chopper can take you back to the parking lot free of charge."
"Charge the fucking bastards, Jayhawk,"
McCarthy said.
"Jesus, I don't know about you in business. You can't make money if you're going to be a softy."
The banter about the bunker got louder and more outrageous. Make the customers throw bits of food to the rats and pop leeches on the tables. Make them fill 100 sandbags as a cover charge. Make them squat on their haunches or sit on a wet floor. Make them get their water by licking the overhead pipes. Make them piss in the corners. Make them walk back to the parking lot only to find their car stolen. Soon all five were standing, stamping their feet and chanting over and over,
"No resupply! No medevacs! No maps!"
Finally, Hawk sat down. The rest followed.
"It didn't ever work," Hawk said, taking a drink.
"Why not, Jack?"
Goodwin asked.
"The government would never give us a license to blow up half the customers."
There was a moment's silence. Then Murphy raised his glass.
"Here's to the bunker,"
he said. His head jerked up toward the raised glass.
"And all the customers,"
Hawk said. There was another silence while they toyed with their glasses.
"Ah, fuck you guys," Murphy said. "You don't know a good time when you have one."
"Typical fucking life for Murphy," Mellis said. "Every shitty thing's a good time for you guys. That's why the government will always get you to do its shitty jobs for it."
Mellis tossed back the rest of his drink and put the glass on the table.
"You're fucking fools."
Everyone was quiet. McCarthy was clearly suppressing a smile. He caught Hawk's eye and then looked toward Murphy. Mellis didn't pick up on the fact that he was sailing in treacherous waters.
"Someone's got to do the shitty jobs, Mel,"
Murphy said, wrapping his hands around his empty glass.
"Well, I've done all the shitty jobs they'll ever get me doing. I'm getting the fuck out. Fuck you and your government if you're dumb enough to stay in."
"How in the hell do you expect the fucking Marine Corps to ever get its shit together if you chicken shit assholes fuck off and leave it because you figure you can make more money someplace else?"
"Suck out, Murph. All the fucking money in the world wouldn't keep my ass in the crotch."
"So why are you leaving?"
"I fucking hate it, that's why,"
Mellis said.
"I'm sick of the fucking lies and covering the lies with blood."
"I'll drink to that,"
McCarthy said, and belched.
That's no fucking answer,
Murphy said. His beefy arms rested in pools of spilt bourbon. The others were sitting back in their chairs, silly grins on their faces, watching Mellis and Murphy pair off, the hare and the bear.
You guys take off and leave it to the liars and the ass-lickers, and the troops get fucked over worse. You're just chicken shit to stand up in public with a goddamn short haircut because you're afraid you'll never get laid.
Instead of accepting that the jibe hurt because it was true, Mellis lost his temper.
You stand the fuck up,
he said, rising from his chair. His fists were clenched. McCarthy pulled him down by the back of his utility jacket.
Jesus, Mellis, Murphy will kill you. Just because he hit a fucking sore spot doesn't mean you have to become a human sacrifice over it. Murphy's right,
Hawk said.
Since you've been in the Corps, Mellis, how many women you dated that have gone to college and aren't Southern? Fuck all! That's how many,
McCarthy answered for him.
Right, Hawk said. You go up to D.C. and there's all sorts of college girls working for all sorts of government offices, but you're there in your short fucking haircut and you're a nigger in Georgetown if ever there was one. Thank you, Theodore J. Hawk,
Mellis said.
Another pea-green philosopher.
He thought of Karen Elsked and felt empty. Hawk leaned back in his chair.
You think I'm lying? In 6 months, you two...
He was pointing at Mellis and McCarthy.
6 months after you're out of the Corps, if you get out of this place alive, you'll be goddamn long-haired commie intellectuals telling everybody how fucked up the war is and how you knew all along. And you know what? You'll be lying. Lying so you can get ahead in their world. You'll be wearing your hair down to your ass, smoking dope, and marching and protesting and wearing fucking beads and sandals just like the rest of them. And you'll be doing it for no other reason than to make the girls like you.
Fuck off, Hawk,
McCarthy said.
I won't fuck off.
Hawk leaned back into the table.
You'll both be afraid to go back to the world and tell all those assholes that you were good fucking Marines.
Oh, you weren't Marine legends. You weren't even the best, but you were good. And you try to tell everyone how bad you were and how sorry you are so you won't have to explain how it really is. How good it can feel to do something so bad.
You're fucking drunk, McCarthy said. But I'll drink to that.
He did, draining his glass and then smacking it down on the table.
I fucking volunteered.
Didn't we all?
Mellis said. He stood and raised his glass, nearly falling in the process.
Here's to the fucking volunteers.
Everyone solemnly stood. Hawk was weaving uncertainly. Murphy and Goodwin were leaning against each other. They touched glasses and drank. Then Mellis turned and looked directly at Hawk. He held his empty glass in front of his face and, looking over it at Hawk with his good eye, quietly said,
Bravo has died. Bravo is risen. Bravo will fight again.
Then he raised the glass above his head.
Mea culpa,
he added. Hawk's eyes focused for a moment, and he solemnly made the sign of the cross.
Absolution,
he said, somewhat slurred. His eyes became unfocused again. Mellis smiled his thanks, and he and Hawk clinked glasses. Mellis looked for a moment at his empty glass and then let it drop to the floor. It broke. He took a full glass and held it above his head while he made a complete turn. Then he dipped his thumb and two fingers into the whiskey and began to anoint those around him with solemn ceremonial movements of his wrist, chanting,
Dulce et decorum est pro patria mori. Dulce et decorum est pro patria mori.
Hawk knelt down and stuck his tongue out. McCarthy solemnly placed a piece of cracker on it. He picked up a whiskey glass with both hands and began to pour the contents slowly on Hawk's head. The whiskey dripped down Hawk's face.
Then McCarthy made the sign of the cross over Hawk's head and chanted, "In the name of the Colonel and the Three and a Do-Nothing Congress." Hawk knelt there with his tongue out, catching the amber liquid as it dribbled down his face. McCarthy then held up his fingers in a V, the peace sign, and turned slowly around, his arm raised high over his head. He intoned to the now silent crowd, "Peace, my peace I give you." Then, with his thumb and two adjoining fingers together, high above his head, he turned a complete circle, saying, "Deliver us from every evil and grant us peace in our day." After that he took the empty glass, looked at it for a moment, and shattered it against the wall. Hawk threw himself over backward and lay on the floor, spread-eagled, staring drunkenly at the ceiling.
"Hey, Jack," Goodwin said. "This party's getting too fucking religious."
In Cassidy's room they passed around some beers. They felt the closeness that arises from sharing, as in passing a peace pipe. Hawk talked about his number one squaw. She'd written him a letter saying that she had a new boyfriend and that she couldn't go on writing to him because she was opposed to what he was doing. The five of them drank to her continued good health and moral fiber. Malice could tell that Hawk was hurt badly, but Hawk didn't let on and drank with everyone else, mocking the end of the relationship. Eventually the beers were finished, and Goodwin, Murphy, and McCarthy wandered out to get 2 hours of sleep before pushing off on the operation. Hawk and Mellis were left alone. Mellis was bone-weary and his head was spinning. He wanted to sleep, but knew this was their last night together before their new formal relationship added a layer of complication. Tomorrow Hawk would be the skipper and Mellis the executive officer. They fiddled with the empty beer cans in an embarrassed silence. Finally, Mellis gently tossed his empty beer can at Hawk and said, "You scared about going back to the bush?"
"Why do you think I'm fucking drunk?"
They were silent a moment. "I'm glad you've got the company, Ted. It would have been a disaster if I had gotten it." Hawk smiled and shook his head.
"Mellis, you dumb shit. You didn't have a chance of getting it. You're still a boot, motherfucker."
Mellis smiled and nodded his head in agreement. "Yeah, but it still would have been a disaster."
"Fuck, Mellis. You'll make first lieutenant in another month or so. Then a few months after that, you'll be shot and all you'll want to do is go home. So that's when they'll offer it to you, when you won't want it anymore. But there won't be any better alternative, so you'll take it on. And you'll be the best alternative."
Mellis laughed, pleased and embarrassed at the praise.
"Anyway, it'll be a pleasure to work with you. In fact, I'd seriously think about opening up that fucking bar with you if we make it back to the world."
He laughed briefly through his nose.
"The bunker. I'd let all the vets watch the customers through one-way mirrors."
Hawk leaned back and smiled at the roof of the tent. Then he sat up, suddenly sober.
"It's a fucking fantasy, Mellis, at least for 18 years.
"What do you mean?"
"I went regular."
"No."
"Yeah,"
Hawk said. He tried to sound lighthearted.
"Wrapping myself in Marine Corps scarlet and gold."
Mellis said nothing. Hawk fumbled for the right words, looking at his crumpled beer can rather than at Mellis.
"You know, shit. I don't know what the fuck I'd do once I got back to the world. You're different. You'll go to fucking law school or something and walk right on up to the top."
"Me?
Shit. There's good people here. Mulvaney, Coates, Cassidy, even Stevens. He tries."
He looked up at Mellis.
"Good guys. Good officers."
"If I hadn't thrown my fucking beer can at you, I'd toast you."
Mellis lay back on the rack and stared at the folds of the tent above him, watching the play of shadows from the single candle.
"Murphy's right. The troops get fucked even worse if the good guys don't stand."
Mellis thought in silence about the old Bravo company, now gone, scattered to hospitals in Japan or the Philippines, or in rubberized body bags on commercial airliners heading across the Pacific toward home. "Tell me something, Hawk," Mellis said, not looking at him but just watching the shadows on the ceiling. "Before you become Bravo Six," he couldn't resist adding a small bite, "and a regular," Hawk flipped him the bird, "why did the colonel send us up the fucking hill the second time?" Mellis's voice started to tremble. It caught him by surprise. "The gooks weren't running. Doubt the company could have done it." Hawk took some time before he answered. "Because you volunteered. He'd cut the order for the assault, but at the last minute he told Fitch that he'd switch in Delta if Fitch didn't want to do the job." Mellis sat up. The tears that had started to form when he began talking about the assault were shut off, but his throat constricted. "What?" "Simpson told Fitch he had two choices, get the company's pride back for abandoning Matterhorn, which is why there had to be another assault, or be a yellow-livered dog and let Delta Company clean up Bravo's mess." He paused. "And all that entails. You know how small the Marine Corps is?"
"If I'd known," Fitch volunteered, "I'd have wanted to kill him, too," Mellis said quietly, almost musingly.
"And if you'd been faced with the same choice, you'd have volunteered just like Fitch," Hawk said.
"I know it," Mellis answered.
"You still feel like killing Simpson?"
"Nah. You know, I went crazy up there. He was just doing his job."
Mellis lay back on the cot.
"I just wish he'd do it sober."
He laughed, and Hawk joined in. Then they lapsed into silence.
"The funny thing is," Mellis said, "I still like Fitch. I'd have gone up the hill with him, even if I knew."
"Before or after you would have killed him?"
"Both."
The two were again quiet. The alcohol blurred Mellis's vision and threatened to pull him into sleep. Then he surfaced again.
"He still volunteered as a poor fucking bastard. He'll carry that a lot longer than a bad fitness report. And here I've been feeling bad because I enjoy killing people."
Hawk laughed quietly.
"At least you're over the hump on that one. It's the people who don't know it who are dangerous. There's at least 200 million of them back in the world. Boot camp doesn't make us killers. It's just a fucking finishing school."
He gave a bitter laugh.
"I remember my ex-fucking squaw telling me it was inconceivable. That was her word. Inconceivable that she could ever go to Vietnam like I did, no matter what the consequences. This was just before she went to Europe for a junior year and met her new boyfriend."
With one hand, Hawk crushed the beer can he was holding. He began to work the mangled can back and forth, twisting it, bending it. Mellis didn't say anything.
"None of them have ever met the mad monkey inside us," Hawk added. "But we have."
"There it is," Mellis said. Hawk's voice became softer and softer.
"Maybe we could have an amusement park across the street with a ride called the Mad Monkey."
He lay across the cot, feet on the floor, eyes closed.
"You're about to crash, Jayhawk," Mellis said gently. "Fuck if I am,"
Hawk mumbled.
"I was just resting my eyes."
They both laughed at the old joke. Then Hawk's breathing became slow and regular.
"Hey," Mellis said.
"Jayhawk."
"Hmm."
Mellis lifted Hawk's feet up on the cot, put a poncho liner over him, and blew out the candle. The tent was plunged into blackness. Mellis made his way through the rain and darkness to the Bravo Company supply tent and rolled up in his poncho liner. He fell asleep on the metal runway floor, listening to the wheezes and grunts of the sleeping strangers who would soon share his life so intimately. Someone was shaking him awake.
What the fuck is it?
He whispered, his head aching badly.
It's me, China, sir.
God damn, China, what the fuck do you want?
Mellis rolled over. His wounded eye was pounding even worse than his head. He wondered what he'd done with the patch or whether he'd lost it someplace. Then he found it on top of his head.
Lieutenant Mellis, you gotta help. There's gonna be trouble tonight.
What do you mean?
I mean, I think there's gonna be someone killed, China whispered.
Mellis heard a scraping sound outside the tent behind China. Then a match was struck, and he saw Mole lighting a candle. Mole's face, like China's, was tense and worried. Mellis said,
Oh, fuck, I gotta piss. Give me a fucking second.
Mellis stood outside the flap of the tent and peered into the darkness and cold. When he returned, China and Mole were talking in low whispers. The others were sound asleep, except for the new lieutenant, who was staring at the three of them wide-eyed but keeping out of things. Mellis led them outside.
Now what the fuck's going on?
Mellis whispered. He was fully dressed, not having undressed when he had collapsed on the floor.
It's Cassidy, sir, China said. I think they're gonna frag him tonight. I wanted to just throw a fucking fake in, you know, to make a statement, but they're gonna waste him instead. They said a fucking pop won't get nothing done.
But Cassidy's in fucking Quang Tri, Mellis said. What the fuck can I do about that?
No, he's not, sir. He come back. We saw the lights on in there tonight.
China's words jerked Mellis's spine straight.
Jesus Christ, he whispered.
The Jayhawk's in there.
Mole, startled, looked at China.
That's why we couldn't find him.
Mellis started running. He could think only of getting Hawk out of Cassidy's rack. He felt sick and wanted to throw up, but kept running. Mole flew past Mellis, his longer legs moving even more swiftly, sprinting with everything he had to reach Hawk. China, who was stockier, came behind. All three were filled with a dread that pushed them like a hand on their backs, racing with them as the low-ground fog swirled beneath their running feet. The explosion ripped through the air and sent Mellis ahead even faster, running as he had never run before, but burdened by despair. Dark shadows flitted away from the tent. Mellis rushed through the entrance just behind Mole. He could see nothing inside. He smelled the sickening, burning odor of TNT. Mellis stumbled over to the rack where he had laid Hawk. The grenade had gone off directly beneath him. Pieces of mattress ticking still hung in the air. What remained of the torn mattress was sticky with blood. He tried to feel where the bleeding was coming from, running his hands over the limp body.
"Get a light!" he screamed. "Get a fucking light!"
Hawk was lying face down. Mellis located Hawk's head and felt his neck for a pulse. There was nothing. He felt beneath his body for his chest and encountered only warm pulp. He'd been laying face down when the grenade went off beneath him. Mellis heard footsteps outside, and then a flashlight shone in through the door. The light shone on Hawk's face. His eyes were open. He must have heard the grenade clunk to the floor just before it exploded. China was trembling in the doorway of the tent with the flashlight. Mole was talking to him quietly, his arm over China's shoulder. They both looked at Mellis, terrified. Mellis began to shake. Unable to control the shaking, he squatted on his haunches, steadying himself on Hawk's rack, looking at Hawk's open eyes. There was no Hawk behind them.
"Bye, Jayhawk," he said, and closed the eyes.
He stood and looked at Mole and China. He wanted to beat them senseless, cut their tongues out for keeping quiet until it was too late. He wanted to scream accusations of murder and send them to prison. At the same time, he knew that nothing would be gained but more bitterness. Justice in the midst of war was a scrap of paper in the wind. If he implicated Henry, he would drag in China and Mole, and he didn't want to do that. Their only sin was the one he'd committed too often himself, not speaking up. Besides, he liked them, and the company couldn't afford to lose its two best machine gunners. He was suddenly aware that he was thinking like the company commander. He had 200 Marines to take care of. Everyone could deal with his own conscience. Melis truly no longer cared about justice or punishment. At least he no longer cared about the kind the courts stood for. Revenge would heal nothing. Revenge had no past. It only started things. It only created more waste, more loss, and he knew that the waste and loss of this night could never be redeemed. There was no filling the holes of death. The emptiness might be filled up by other things over the years, new friends, children, new tasks, but the holes would remain. Melis saw Hawk's tin can cup hanging on his belt suspender over the back of a chair. He unhooked the cup and stuffed it into one of his own pockets. "You two had better get out of here," he said quietly to Mole and China as he walked out past them. Melis stayed around for the inevitable hullabaloo. Bravo Company, to a man, stonewalled, as did he. All he knew was that he'd been asleep when the grenade went off. Any investigators would have to find their way to Henry on their own. If they didn't, so be it. If they did, there'd be insufficient evidence to bring about a trial, much less a conviction. Moreover, there was a war to fight, and no one would benefit from a long and time-consuming murder investigation. When the hullabaloo died down, Melis walked alone to the edge of the deserted landing strip and lay down in the mud. He cried until he could cry no more. Then he just lay there, empty, alone, beneath the slowly graying sky. Goodwin finally found him and helped him up. They walked to the COC bunker, where Blakely informed them that Melis would be the new company commander until a captain arrived. If Melis did a good job, maybe he'd get a company of his own later. Maybe even Bravo Company. His first task, however, once Iger was secured, would be to help the S-1 write up the investigation of the accidental death. Chapter 23. The operation kicked off at 0600 as planned. By 1000, the company was set in and Melis had three patrols out. Only with the coming of evening and its soft fading light could he finally be alone. He hid behind a blasted stump, and he tried to think about meaning. He knew that there could be no meaning to someone who was dead. Meaning came out of living. Meaning could come only from his choices and actions. Meaning was made, not discovered. He saw that he alone could make Hawk's death meaningful by choosing what Hawk had chosen, the company. The things he'd wanted before, power, prestige, now seemed empty and their pursuit endless. What he did and thought in the present would give him the answer, so he would not look for answers in the past or future. Painful events would always be painful. The dead are dead. Forever. Melis longed to go out on patrol, back to the purity and green vitality of the jungle, where death made sense as a part of the ordered cycle in which it occurred, in the dispassionate search for food that involved loss of life in order to sustain life. He thought of the tiger that killed Williams. The jungle and death were the only clean things in the war. The warm evening was a harbinger of the post-monsoon heat that would soon follow. Melis felt the dark night beginning to enfold him like a woman's arms. The listening posts were out. So were the major stars, brilliant in the sky. Toward Laos, lazy green NVA tracers and anti-aircraft fire floated beautifully above the horizon. The NVA were trying to kill an American pilot. But the distance made the effort seem no more than a slow-motion fireworks display. Melis felt a slight breeze from the mountains rustling across the grass valley below him to the north. He was acutely aware of the natural world. He imagined the jungle pulsing with life, quickly enveloping Matterhorn, Iger, and all the other shorn hilltops, covering everything. All around him the mountains and the jungle whispered and moved,
as if they were aware of his presence, but indifferent to it. He started to fix coffee, knowing he'd need the caffeine to stay awake through the night, and it would soon be too dark for him to heat anything safely. Hawk's old pear-can cup felt familiar and good. Mellis had found comfort in it several times already that day as he carefully and mindfully brewed coffee, remembering Hawk. When he finished making the coffee, he took a careful first sip. The edge of the cup was heated to a satisfying lip-burning temperature. He became aware of someone down on the lines below him, tapping out a rhythm on a drum made from a sea ration box. It was a strange, wild, strong rhythm. It grew loud, then soft, but it was always fierce. Then soft voices, chanting in a weird atonal harmony, rose like spirits from the earth below him. As the rhythm became stronger, the voices became more intense, although not really louder. Gradually he could make out the words of the chant, as if he had tuned into its frequency. The words chilled him, but at the same time lifted his soul skyward. The voices were chanting the names of the dead. If it's good enough for Jacobs, then it's good enough for me. If it's good enough for Jacobs, then it's good enough for me. If it's good enough for Jacobs, then it's good enough for me. Good enough for me. Good enough for me. The voices chanted on. With each new name, the rhythm would be altered to fit the syllables. Mellis walked slowly down the hill to find the chanters, being careful not to spill his hot coffee. They were Con Man, Mole, and Gambaccini. Mole was drumming the sea ration box. The three of them were staring into the darkness, lost in their rhythm. Mellis sat down. He didn't disturb them. He heard a slight noise behind him and looked up. China was standing there listening and watching. Mellis moved over slightly and patted the ground next to him. China sat down. Mellis lifted the hot tin can cup and a silent toast to Hamilton. He handed it to China, who took a drink and handed it back. Neither said a word. If it's good enough for Short Round, then it's good enough for me. Each of the names evoked a remembered face, an outstretched hand reaching down from a rock or across a rushing stream, or a look of fear as a friend realized that death had come for him. If it's good enough for Parker, then it's good enough for me. Mellis tried to shake off the other images, the burned bodies, the smell, the stiff awkwardness beneath the wet ponchos. He couldn't. The chanting went on, the musicians giving in to the rhythm of their own being, finding healing in touching that rhythm, and healing in chanting about death, the only real God they knew. Mellis didn't sleep that night. He sat on the ground and stared out to the northwest, toward Matterhorn. He watched the mountains subtly change under the shadows of clouds cast by a waning moon as it moved across the sky, until the shadows began to fade with the coming of light in the east. He tried to determine if there was meaning in the fact that cloud shadows from moonlight could move across the mountains and yet nothing on the mountain would move or even be affected. He knew that all of them were shadows, the chanters, the dead, the living, all shadows, moving across this landscape of mountains and valleys, changing the pattern of things as they moved, but leaving nothing changed when they left. Only the shadows themselves could change.
This concludes the reading of Matterhorn, a novel of the Vietnam War, by Carl Marlantis. Copyright 2010 by Carl Marlantis. This book was read by Bronson Pinchot. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with Grove Atlantic Incorporated and El Leon Literary Arts, and was produced in 2010 by Blackstone Audio, Inc., which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio, Inc. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.